All right. Thank you very much for coming here today, and welcome to the 14th Annual Tessa Bartholomew's Lecture in Religion, hosted by the Department of Religion of Florida State University. My name is Christina Berman. I'm an assistant professor working on Japanese religions. I'm really glad that all of you were able to come here today. I am honored and pleased to be able to introduce Jason Ananda Josephson, Associate Professor of Religion and Chair of the Department of Religion at Williams College. Dr. Josephson got his Master's in Theological Studies from Harvard University in 2001 and his PhD in Buddhist Studies from Stanford in 2006. Dr. Josephson's work is, I think, very interesting because he combines the study of Buddhism, particularly Japanese Buddhism, with a deeper theoretical understanding of the study of religion, particularly the history of the study of religion. And you can see this in some of the papers that articles that he's published. For example, we have Evil Cults, Monstrous Gods, and the Labyrinth of Delusion, Defining Heresy in Meiji Japan. But also, for example, forthcoming, Specters of Reason, Kantian Things, and Fragile Terrors of Philosophy. So we're really bridging the East and West divide. Nowhere is, I think, this more evident than in his book, published in 2012 from the University of Chicago Press, The Invention of Religion in Japan, which was also winner of the 2013 Distinguished Book of the Year Award from the Society for the Scientific Study of Religion. And so without further intervening things, I would like to turn the floor over to Dr. Josephson.
Hello, everybody. So to start, I'd just like to express my appreciation at being invited here. Thanks to Christina and Jimmy, Brian, and a whole bunch of friends and colleagues here. And thank you all for coming. It's a real pleasure to be here and to have a chance to talk to you about something that's very important to me. So what I'm going to be talking to you about today is a kind of once and future project. And let me say what I mean by that. So when I wrote this book, and I originally wrote it, and it was way too long. I'll tell you what this book's argument is and some pieces of it. But I wrote it, and I didn't know that presses only want things that are about 100,000 words. And I wrote something that was like 200,000 words and sent it to an editor, and they were like, there's got to be something that's got to go. And the biggest piece that had to be cut was an extensive discussion of Buddhism. And so I pulled that out, and the vestiges of it, of this talk, which I've been thinking about in the back of my head. I have a few intermediate books that I'm pushing out, that's, you know, one that's just finished and a version of it, another that I'll be finishing up next year. So this is a little bit on the horizon when I'll return to the this Buddhism talk. But it's in that sense, it came out of this and is a sort of sequel to it. I'm not going to assume any of you have read it, this book, but I'll tell you about the whole story as it moves in. But its main intervention is in some sense parallel to the intervention of this book, which is that I'm trying to take on the category religion. In a different sense. For generations, philosophers, scholars have assumed that religion was a built-in part of human nature or culture. The assumption was that it was a universal part of human experience, found everywhere. The individual atheist or not believer, maybe as the exception, but people assumed religion was built in. I think that's wrong. And I'm part of a critique that a group of scholars that are now an increasing influence in religious studies, but that have called to come into question the universality of the category religion. This is often called the critical turn in religious studies. But I'm also intervening in that criticism in a particular way, in two particular ways. That critical turn has shown that the category religion emerged in a Christian European context with particular European colonial trajectories built into it. But that critical turn had left the impression that religion was then sort of forced on the globe with little or no resistance. So you get books about the British invention of Hinduism or the Jesuit invention of Confucianism, where there are no Indian actors, where Indian people would seem not to be playing part of the conversation for the construction of these categories. And one of the things that move was important, it was a decolonizing move, but in a way it disempowered the very people it was trying to make empowered. And so what I wanted to do was restore the voices of Japanese intellectuals, of Asian intellectuals in that conversation and show what agency they had, how they contributed to the formation of various categories. The other piece of the intervention, in a way, is also that there's some version of this argument that goes, religion is not a universal, so the assumption is so it's nothing or something. I mean, there's some weird disconnect there around that. What I want to look at is the modernization process that, in a sense, produced religions as artifacts of modernity. I'll try and explain that here, but this is a very specific case study in that argument. Thinkers like Almond have traced the European construction of Buddhism, but they've done so without paying much attention to the folks on the other side of that encounter. But they also have missed the problems that resulted from the European construction of Buddhism in European thought. Conversations about Buddhist modernism have shown how modernism may have changed Buddhism, but not how Buddhism changed modernism. And I'm trying to, in that sense, invert it. I'm trying to show how the construction of the object, Buddhism, changed things for European thinkers. And I'm also going to be talking today a little bit about Japanese thinkers discovering suddenly that they were practicing a religion that was called Buddhism, that it had certain transnational features to it, and trying to figure out how to change Buddhism and in what way they had to do that. And the talk is going to be, I'm not going to read very much, most of it. I'm just going to try and talk through. In that sense, it'll be informal, but I hope informative. And I also have an apology at the outset. Pascal famously said, I would have written a shorter letter, but I didn't have the time. I would have written a shorter talk, but I ran out of time. So there are bits of it that I will provide evidence on the screen that I, for those of you who might listen in this recording, if my voice doesn't cause it to blow out, you'll miss. I'll put some evidence up as we go through. I'll speed up and slow down depending on how much time I have. And that's how it'll work. So apologies for that. Anyway, I'll have to talk through basically a book and a half today. Let me start. When should I stop talking by? Okay. One might imagine that by the 17th century at the latest, Europe should have discovered Buddhism. European scholars, if they've been looking for it, Christian scholars, if they had been looking for it, could have encountered the Buddha more than 1,000 years earlier in the account of Archelaus's disputation with the heresiarch Manes in the 320 CE, buried in the 6th catechesis of Cyril of Jerusalem in the 4th century, in the heresies of Epiphanius in the 4th century, or described with tantalizing detail in Clement of Alexandria's Miscellanies of the 3rd century of the Common Era. Later, they might have seen references to Buddhism in the accounts of early travelers, like Giovanni da Pian del Carpine, Wilhelm von Heusbruck, and Marco Polo. But despite Europeans exploring and even colonizing the Buddhist world, there is no reference to Buddhism as a transnational phenomena in any of these sources. You think if you had a positive account of history where Buddhism would be produced suddenly by anthropological encounter, it should have been a feature of the Age of Discovery, like the Cape of Good Hope. But it wasn't. Even in the 17th century, Buddhism fails to appear in the writings of European intellectuals, and it wasn't until after 500 years of exploring and colonizing the Buddhist world before a concept of Buddhism appears in the European horizon. Why this long gap? What appeared in its place? Those are some of the questions I'm going to try and answer. Why did they produce a category for Buddhism in the end? Similarly, Buddhists, again in quotes, on the other side of the encounter, experienced centuries of Christian mission without ever requiring a second-order category of religion,
In East Asian sources, one can find in retrospect tantalizing intimations of Christian mission and the references to Persian monks and the Tang Huaiyao from 961 CE or the Seifu Wanggui of 1013 CE. One can find an odd text giving an argument for monotheism that might seem out of place in the Yishen Lun in 641 CE. And of course, there was a famous Nestorian stele of Xi'an erected in 781, which was covered in praises for a creator god whose symbol was the cross, but which then apparently stood forgotten for almost 800 years. In the cultural arena I know best, Japanese intellectuals weathered a full so-called Christian century of missionary encounter, translating texts, encountering Christian missionaries without ever producing a new category, such as religion, I quote, to encompass Christianity. Indeed, as I argue in this book, the Japanese legal codes that exile the Christian missionaries from the Japanese islands did so without recognizing their true degree of difference. So this question, we'll also talk about that. What appeared a little bit before, when they encountered Christians, why didn't the Buddhists come up with a new second-order category like religion? More succinctly, the talk will look at the process by which Buddhism, I'm going to do these air quotes that you can't hear, but imagine a lot of my words have air quotes around them, in which Buddhism was constructed as a religion by showing how an encounter with Buddhism produced the Euro-American conception of religion, and how an encounter with the Western notion of religion then in flux caused the construction of contemporary Japanese Buddhism. The biggest payoff, or the biggest things that might piss people off in what I'm going to argue, is that the encounter with so-called Oriental religions and their inclusion in the category religion is one of the things that both shattered the category religion and produced religious studies as a discipline. And second, Buddhism as a religion, this is in a sentence in quotes, was in some sense produced in Japan in a radical restructuring that resulted from the encounter with the European concept of religion. So those are the two bits of what I'm going to talk about. And for what time we've got, well, anyway, here's some version of it. I'll do the European encounter first, and then we'll look at the Japanese encounter second. Before we need to do that, a few observations about the proto-history of the term religion. Religion is an early modern term. The term, our modern, in most European languages, the term religion sounds pretty similar. We have in French, religion, in German, religion, in Portuguese, religião, in Russian, religie. All of these sound very similar, and it's because they share their origins in the Latin religio. The surprise for people who, maybe for the undergraduates or people in the audience who don't know the history of the term, is that for the vast Middle Ages, where you would imagine people were most religious, the term religio does not appear. When it does, it refers to Christian monks. It doesn't refer to anything we would recognize as religion. It doesn't occur in the Bible. It doesn't occur in a whole range of medieval sources. Instead, it's in the early modern period that the term religion appears after the Protestant Reformation. First as a term for Christian piety, and then only much later as a kind of anthropological category. Here is a version of it from Purchas's Pilgrimage from 1613, and this is what its early meaning was in English. The true religion can be one, and that which God himself teacheth. All other religions being but strayings from him, whereby men wander in the dark and in labyrinthine error. That's the archaic spelling there. This Purchas's Pilgrimage was an important source for the globalization of the idea that there were plural religions. But it's the categorical schema in the back of the early modern one was different than the one that we have today. It tended to look like this. Christianity, Judaism, Mahometanism, which we would now call Islam with some shift in meaning, and then a final category for idolatry, paganism, sometimes called gentilism, that were treated as near synonyms. But the first thing to notice is that these are not equal members of the category religion. As you can tell already from this quote of Purchas, there was one true religion, Christianity. Sometimes even Catholicism was not considered Christianity, so we could be even more narrowly specified than that. And various forms of false religion, things that either Judaism, they believed was false because Jews had resisted conversion to Christianity, and it had a true message that had been lost, this polemically. Mohammedanism or Islam, they thought of as a Christian heresy, something that emerged from Christianity, but that was basically false. And then they had this messy category of idolatry or paganism that they thought was what the devil had strewn over the world. Scholars of religious studies are not going to find this list particularly surprising, and we know that many of the biggest shifts were in this later category. But let's just note that, for example, in early writings about India in the same period, we get the inhabitants in general of Indostan were all anciently Gentiles, which means Gentiles meaning pagans. And we have the production of the word Gentu or Gentu out of a Indus. Gentiles gets collapsed together. It may also be a misreading of the Portuguese. And Gentu becomes one of our bases for Hindu. So it's not the only one, but basically the Hindus were the pagans of India. It's a geographic marker. It doesn't have many of the main features that we do. And it explicitly dismisses Hinduism as false and diabolical, associated with the devil. The devil is the author of idolatry. It wasn't the case that idolatry was false because it was mistaken about its gods. Idolatry was supposed to be false because there were supposed to be literally demons behind the faces of idols. So they granted many gods, but instead of calling them gods, the Christians described them as demons. But in a way, they didn't need to produce new terminology as long as terms like Gentoo were understood as synonyms to the paganism of India. They fitted in this old category schema. So my question becomes, when did this schema start to fall apart? When did this category of idolatry or paganism, that isn't a highlighter button, start to turn into our modern list of world religions? Well, one of the issues, we can see the transformation happening around Buddhism, and Buddhism is key to that. In early European writings, even before the category Buddhism is in place, in places we would now call the Buddhist world, but that they obviously didn't then, we have descriptions of idolatry. Here we have Montanus's dog-headed Amida, based on nothing. Not nothing, but very little. Here we have Athanasius the Kircher's pagodas, idolatrous pagodas. This was construed, this is Asian, this was supposed to be both in China or in Japan and then in China. This is the idolatry that they were seeing. And we can see this argument of, even before Buddhism, and I really should put that in quotes at the top there, a category of idolatry emerging as a literal synonym. For example, in some of the very first dictionaries of this part of the world, the Dictionarium Animiticum Lusitanum et Latinum, Dictionary of Vietnamese, Portuguese, and Latin, 1615. It's a very influential dictionary of Vietnamese. They have this word Phat in Vietnamese, which we would now translate as Buddha, but it translates into Latin and Portuguese as idol. And so that case, every time they ran across a reference to Buddha in or Buddha's plural in a Vietnamese source, they translated it as idolatry. So in a way, what they were able to do, and we have other sources that see versions of this in other parts of that world, other quotes, what they were doing is describing different kinds of idolatry. They didn't think that they had any connection to each other necessarily. The idol worshippers of Sri Lanka were probably different than the idol worshippers of China. There was nothing that they saw initially to connect them. Europeans didn't yet produce new terminology. The problem first becomes, however, when they start to see different kinds of priests, European colonists start to see different kinds of priests that they think of as dedicated to these idols. A lot of the language is priests of the idol.
And the problem with that,
once they discover that these are celibate priests, with some kind of organizational structure, is that it didn't fit their idea of what idolatry was supposed to look like. Idolatry wasn't supposed to require asceticism and dedication. Idolatry was supposed to be, in many of these conceptions of idolatry, had a plurality to it, a plurality of deities. And so they started to worry a little bit about an institution, but it really didn't change their argument profoundly. It started to put pressure on it. And they started to see some parallels that already in the 16th century, they haven't noticed in the 17th century, they started to try and explain. One of the most influential thinkers around this issue is this guy, Athanasius Kircher, and his Pogromus. He sort of births Coptic studies, and he has other sources around China. And he basically thought that there was some Egyptians who had spread their idolatry throughout the world, including into what we now call China and Japan. So when they saw it, they thought, okay, we can fit it back into our system of idolatry. It's Egyptian idolatry. We know what we're seeing here. So, you know, we see this, you know, source here, Alexander Ross, the Pansavia, of what religion were the Xinhuas or the Chinese. They were always and still are idolaters, basically continues and then concludes, they worship also the devil out of love. Not out of love, but fear. And the idea is that idolatry was spread by the devil. It wasn't like spread by mistakes, it was spread by the devil. Okay. So this is an early attempt to fit Buddhism into this, or what we will now recognize as Buddhism, into this schema. And but the problem, something else started to bother them. The Christian thinkers, this happens in a bunch of different places, but European colonials started asking them what the Buddhists thought of God, or whether they worshipped, what was their God. And the idea was, as idolaters, they should have gods. We know in the Japanese case, they were unable to, this was an unintelligible question to them, partially for linguistic reasons. We know that in other parts of the world, European thinkers, when they went to Africa or, for example, North America, they often thought that the claim that the native peoples had no idea of God, they asked them, you know, what is your God? And they didn't have any good answers. So the natives were like, oh, you're worse than savage. The Europeans said, the indigenous peoples were worse than savage because they didn't even have any civilization. But in and around China and Japan, they saw a more robust institutionalized something. But they started to think that maybe it didn't have God. There's a long history of this that also has to do with the Jesuits and their translation of Confucianism. But they started to get the idea that there were people living in East Asia who had monasteries, or at least an organized and literate culture, but who were perhaps atheists. The Christians would write about this as if they were externally idolatrous, but secretly and privately atheist. In some cases, they were talking about groups we would now later want to re-identify as Confucian, but the idea was that they were atheists. And this was a big problem for European thought. Why was this a big problem for European thought? Well, it's the quotes that I've got up here illustrate. Many Europeans thought that the very idea of a true atheism was impossible. European Christian thinkers in the 16th century, Jacques de Valais, in a text that was burned because it was so controversial, The Art of Believing in Nothing, as the title translates, said that nobody can really be an atheist. They quoted Psalms to justify this. The idea is that people who claim to be atheists really have God, but they're denying him. They're trying to use their consciousness to deny God, but deep in their hearts, there is a God, and so they're conflicted and they're screwed up. But nobody can really deny God. And this was one of the main arguments for the existence of God, was an argument called the consensus gentium, but the idea that everybody all over the world either has a god or they're idolaters. See, they believe in Christianity, or they've misdirected God to target some other god by accident or by diabolical purpose. But the possibility of an atheistic Asia
freaked them out, freaked out European thinkers, started to put pressure on the category religion itself, contributed to an internal debate, how much time do I have, around, and actually what happened is they then started worrying that that there might not only be atheists in East Asia, but that there might be atheists within Europe. And they, this is tied up with the reception of Spinoza, who a famous Jewish philosopher or Jewish heretic, as they call them, who they identified with China and Japan, as we see here in Bale's Historical Critical Dictionary of 1702. And so they started to worry that not only was Chinese thought atheistic, and not only was Spinoza atheistic, but later they started to worry that European thought, European philosophy, might have in its own core a kind of atheism, which for which they coined the term nihilism, or Frederick Jacobi did in the following generation, to talk about Spinozism. So the idea was, not only was there an atheism, but it was an atheistic religion. And that really bothered European thinkers. It was too organized to be any kind of generic idolatry, and it was atheistic. And they also started to put references to things like Fo or Shaka in different languages together, and to start to piece them together as something that they started to call the Buddha, as the generic term for it. Fast forwarding a little, so it's in 1820 where Europeans start using the term Buddhism for the first time. And when they do, when they start to add together all the things that they think of are in the Buddhist world, it's the at that time the largest religion in the world. And so suddenly not only do they have a world that has no direct affiliation to their particular intellectual conception, but also they feel outnumbered. And it starts to put pressure on the category religion itself, and starts to push for new terminologies and new ways of defining religion. How do you define religion if it's not worship directed at a particular god? Max Müller, famous founder of religious studies, in this moment births religious studies around this conversation. And Buddhism is a non-trivial touch point in this. We can see from this quote from his Natural Religion in 1889, people disagree about the religion. Quote, most people, whatever their opinions, might be on other points, would probably hold that religion must always have something to do with God or the gods, but even that is not the case. Buddhism, for instance, which is a creed professed by the largest number of human beings, recognizes, taught by Buddha Shakyamuni, no God, or at all events, no creator of the universe. This is a real problem for Müller, and it's not the only example of an atheistic religion. There were, he uses examples from within the European context, things like Monist Leagues, which were our version of Dawkins's organized new atheism, etc. But Buddhism is a key example for that. And the debates are, continue to be whether Buddhism fits into the category religion, in what way does it fit? Even by the term's general acceptance, there were some people who could have imagined Buddhism being all a superstition, all a philosophy, all a kind of politics. And a little bit earlier, it was unclear what category organization to put Buddhism in. Was Buddhism a subtype of Hinduism? Were the various traditions of Japan and China and India and Tibet so different that they deserve different names? Lamaism, for example, was a popular one for what we call Tibetan Buddhism now. But the conclusion was that there was something... sorry. We all need to cry sometimes. but this idea that there was something called Buddhism that was huge, that outnumbered European traditions, and that was in some sense either atheistic or nihilistic, that's the other term that they used to talk about it, is an issue of conversation throughout the early field of religious studies. It becomes a problem. Disciplines are formed in and around often kind of counterintuitive things, right? Like, happiness studies only feels like it counts as a science when it can tell you that having children makes you less happy, for example. Religious studies formed in and around counterintuitive ideas of the category religion for a European context. They were not counterintuitive for other parts of the world, but it
its call to scientificity was around this hole, this problematic, which is the category religion. We could go through more thinkers in the field, but I guess I won't do that right now. I want to note a little footnote, because while Mueller is trying to think about Buddhism, you might want to know, where did he get his idea of Buddhism from? And there are already, one of the people he talked to was a Japanese thinker, Nanjo Bunyu, who was already there and studying with Mueller. And part of this project to come up with what Buddhism was, and Mueller was trying to codify its scriptures, was done in dialogue with Japanese intellectuals. I'll return to that in a few minutes. The take-home message of this part of the talk should be that European thinkers produced different conceptions of an Asia that troubled them at different points. They often tried to contain that Asia by producing a new conversation or a new conceptual apparatus, but it kept escaping in one way or another. It forced, once they had idea of a list of religions that made sense to them in a particular way, it no longer made sense under the pressure of people to fail to convert or to fit into their hierarchies. Similarly, categories like Buddhism got produced as a religion category, from the beginning then starts to produce problems for the category religion itself, and religious studies tends to crystallize around those problematics as well as others. That's at least the first part of this. Let's shift foci for a moment. What about the Japanese side of the encounter? So, talk about it in this book. I'll give you a little bit of this, but I'll then move into stuff that's not in this book. And I'd like to begin this little bit with a particular moment. In 1709, two men were seated across from each other in a courtyard that was functioning as an interrogation chamber. One man was weak, escorted by guards, and tired from days of confinement. He was a quote-unquote savage in the country illegally, and he most likely expected that he was going to die. The man seated across from him had the power of a militarized state at his disposal, with interpreters, bureaucrats, soldiers literally waiting in the wings. This was an anthropological counter, and the asymmetries of power dictated the terms of interaction, turning one man into the position of an ethnographic subject and the other to a scholar or interrogator whose job was to produce meaning. So in that way, the setup, an interrogator of a interrogation of a savage or a captured heretic, was a common type of anthropological encounter that occurred throughout Western Europe in the 18th and 19th centuries. But the particular thing I'm talking about is a reversal, because the prisoner was not some captured tribesman, but a Sicilian Jesuit, Giovanni Battista Sidoti. And his interrogator was an educated Japanese thinker, Are Hakuseki, who was a famous Japanese scholar in his own epoch. And he wrote an ethnography, basically, of this encounter called Seyo Kibun, Tidings from the Western World. Well, not unique historically, that power disparity inverts many assumptions about our relationship between Orient and Occident, or ethnographer and research subject. So I explore, and there's a translation here in the back, in the appendix here of sections of that text, where they talk about Christianity. And what I try and figure out is, this is a period when I'm going to argue Japanese intellectuals didn't yet use a category analogous to religion. And when I wrote my dissertation, I hadn't done this piece of archival work yet, and people asked me, you're saying the Japanese came up with a category for religion in the 19th century. What happened when they encountered missionaries before that? And so I went back in and I found it, and there's a particular terminology that we get in the Japanese sources. I won't read all this, but the term that jumped out at it is something like Jaho or Joshumon, which is a term for a kind of diabolical heresy. And we have one good quote from the Kirishita Monogatari that gives us an example of what this discourse looked like. And it said, the Christian version of the Buddhist Dharma tells us that at the time heaven and earth were opened up, the one Buddha called Deus and Great Lord made his appearance. Barbarians from foreign lands come here to spread this demonic Dharma and make of Japan and demand devils. Their main argument was that the Christian missionaries were a subtype of Buddhism, a diabolical subtype of Buddhism that was dedicated toward colonizing and exploiting people and conquering them in the name of their diabolical demon. So it was a demonological reading, but it didn't involve much new terminological production. They produced this word kirishitan, but otherwise they don't produce a new category. And they basically, as you can see in this last quote from Seso Sosai, they accuse it Christians of plagiarism. They're like, basically, Jesus plagiarized the Buddha, and it's so it's just imitation Buddhism. It's not a real Buddhism. They're not yet putting Buddhism and Christianity into two categories and producing another one above it, right? They're not going Buddhism plus Christianity or both religions. They're saying Christianity is a subtype of the Buddha Dharma, but it's a bad one. It's a defective, heretical imitation. The ironies of the parallel, where both groups are claiming that the other worship the devil, is interesting. And in the book, I also look at what Christian missionaries were writing in the same period. The difference is the Jesuit missionaries don't have the term Buddhism. So they're writing about idolaters, etc., diabolical idolaters, but the term Buddhism does not yet appear. Okay. So what changes? So in a way, again, here, they don't have to produce a category, a new category. But it's something that produces direct social pressure that causes the production of a category. And what happens, and this is in my book in more detail, but is that in the U.S., so for about 250 years, Japan controls its own access to trade, and the Japanese leaders control to a greater or lesser degree what kind of information passes into Japan. But in the 1850s, American warships show up off the coast of Japan, and the Americans demand that the Japanese sign a bunch of trade treaties. But they legitimate those trade treaties by making demands for rights. And in that context, the concept of freedom of religion appears, becomes a matter of debate. And when Japanese intellectuals, they're forced to sign the treaties by American guns, have to figure out what is religion. What do the Europeans mean when they say guarantee freedom of religion? Freedom of what? What's covered by those liberties? Do we have any religions in Japan? What are they really talking about? All of these things they tried to grapple with. And I look at the Japanese translators and their early bafflement around, and I go through treaty drafts and what have you in this text. But it causes the category to arrive and become urgent. The Japanese sign a treaty they're forced to that guarantees freedom of religion, and then they're left to deal with the consequences. As Americans, and then following them, a whole range of Europeans, Russians and French, British, start making more demands on behalf of this freedom. In this context, there are a bunch of debates about how to translate the word religion, not only in the trade treaties, but then Japanese leaders start going abroad to study European civilization for the first time. They start actually, you know, you might think that they didn't have an idea of religion because they hadn't met any, had an anthropological encounter, but then they go abroad and they start studying with European thinkers, but they still debate the category religion and how to translate it. And here are a range of different terms that they produce to define to translate the term religion, each of which has a different kind of implication. To hold up a couple of these, and we know this is these are texts from Japan's first academic journal, the Meiroku Zashi. A couple examples. One figure named Mishiyamane argues that the term religion should be translated as kyomon. It's a term he takes from Buddhist circles. But he argues basically that what freedom of religion means is the freedom of the state to teach people what's really the case, where they know something, and not to teach them about things that we don't have yet scientific knowledge. So it would mean freedom of religion would only be that which is not in conflict with science, and this is a religion that constantly retreats and vanishes as things are understood more and more scientifically, and he wasn't sure if anything in Japan was a religion. On the other hand, people like Kato Hiroyuki use the term Shinto as a generic translation for religion. If that were the case, everybody would have their own shrine. But the hierarchical category under which it would fit would be something like Shinto. Anyway, that's not what wins out. What wins out is a term by another Japanese thinker and later minister of education, Mori Ainori, who uses this term Shukyo, which then gets transposed into China, to Vietnam, to Korea, as the generic term. And Moriarty Nori already, in his works, there starts to be a binary between something called religion, which is a good thing, a private thing, a modern thing, which he uses the word Shukyo to translate, and something called superstition, which is bad belief. If religion is good belief, superstition is bad belief. And the term that Japanese thinkers later settle on for that is Meishin. It's a new term also. Both these terms are totally new. And Meishin, a kind of aberrant belief, perhaps inspired by the German, Aberglauben. So they still debate it, and then they're under pressure to come up with a modern constitution, which they do in 1889. But when they do that, they use yet a different term. Not the one that is in common conversation in Japan, but a particular legal term. And in the Japanese constitution, they have a line that guarantees freedom of religion. Japanese subjects shall, within limits not prejudicial to peace and order, not antagonistic to their duties as subjects, enjoy freedom of religious belief. And they use the term Shinkyo to specify the interiority of that belief. It's a new thing. It's an interior state in a new way. It's a kind of faith, which totally new term again, yet again. So having guaranteed freedom of religion in the Constitution of 1889, the question became what fit into that category. There's functionally a triadic structure in which the state is promoting something as a kind of secular state, and then as fact, as real, as true, and bifurcating two kinds of belief, a kind of permitted belief, which it'll flag as religion, and a backward belief that it'll flag as superstition. I can talk about that more later if you're interested. I think that's one of the common category structures of globalizing modernity is this as a legal structure, but we'll talk about it later. So Buddhists, people discovering, first of all, that they might be part of a transnational phenomena called Buddhism, then have to deal with this category of shukyo, of religion. And the debates are within Japan, yet again, there's a little terminological shift around Buddhism. They're mostly using a repeated term that they used, Bukkyo, the teachings of the Buddha or Buddhas. But the term that occurs more often in the early sources is Buppo, the Buddha Dharma, or just Ho, Dharma, or Law. The term Bukkyo was around, but it takes on a new significance in this period. And they start to argue, is there really a Buddhism of Japan? Is there something distinctive about Japanese Buddhism? And if there is, how does it relate to the category religion? Is it a philosophy? Is it a religion that should be protected? Is it a superstition that they need to get rid of? Some people just, even in Japan, say maybe it's a failed politics. This is one argument that we need to just totally uproot along with the Tokugawa government, along with an older governmental system. So Japanese thinkers start to think about it, and Inoue, one of them is a thinker named Inoue Enryo, who in a series of important works, Bukkyo Katsudan Jodan, and then later the right ladies I've summed up in something called Meishin to Shukyo, Superstition and Religion, argues, so Inoue Enryo is a kind of unusual figure. He's the first Buddhist priest to get a PhD from the University of Tokyo. And he gets his PhD in the Western philosophical tradition, basically. He studied Hegel and Kant and Spencer. And he starts to make the argument not only that Buddhism is a religion, but that actually not all of Buddhism is a religion. Buddhism needs to be transformed. It needs to be revitalized. Because some of what is Buddhism is real Buddhism, he says, and that's the religious or religious/philosophical part of Buddhism, and the rest of it is a superstition. And we need to pare away that part of Buddhism to find the real core of Buddhism that will now fit into this new category. And he starts to define this category initially in negative terms. What do we need to get rid of in order to make Buddhism into a religion, fully a religion? And he acknowledges this as a transformative process, but also describes it as a process of return to ancient India. Here's one list he provides. He's getting this from a government list, but these are some things, that beliefs that people have to get rid of. Don't say that foxes or badgers possess people. Don't say that there's such a thing as winged goblins, etc. Don't believe in dubious rituals. Don't trust in the efficacy of magic or holy water. Don't put trust in divination. It is wrong to be concerned with omens. Don't otherwise do anything similar to the list above. It's a pretty inclusive thing. But so Buddhism needs to internally purify itself of superstitions. And Inoue already thinks it needs to figure out what its core ideas and doctrines are. And this is a kind of key innovation. It's a re-emphasis on standardized doctrinal Buddhism in a new way. And it has implications not only in Inoue, but in a later generation of thinkers who I want to talk a little bit about here. So the next generation of thinkers, or some of these are contemporaries or late contemporaries of Inoue Enryo, thinkers like this guy, Kiyosawa Manchi, he argues, for example, this is a quote on my translation, "For religion today, the most important thing to pay attention to is the distinction between superstition and true belief. True belief should be promoted while superstition must be extinguished." He's writing here to a Buddhist audience about the efficacy of certain kinds of prayer rituals called kito. In the same time period, there is a movement to revive Buddhism, or call it a new Buddhism movement, the Shinbukyoto Doshikai originally. And here's a quote from one of their first kind of manifestos. "There are temples, there are priests, they chant sutras, they preach. Tens of thousands of believers surround them, shedding tears of adoration in magnificent temple halls and showing their reverence for the robes of embroidered brocade. But if this is Buddhism, it is without doubt corrupted conventional old Buddhism. There are those who worship Fudo in order to make gains in the rice business. There are those who perform ceremonies in front of Inari to pray for the healing of an illness. There are those who beg the Dragon King for the safety of a ship. Blah, blah, blah. We do not think that they're motivated by even a fraction of sincere sentiment to discern life's true meanings. We call this superstitious old Buddhism." Meshintiki old Buddhism. So what happens in and around the turn of the century, especially in the early 20th century, these are both colleagues of Inoue Enryo's. Tsukuno Koya had studied with Inoue Enryo. There is a campaign, an internal campaign within Japanese Buddhism to transform it, to standardize it, to change it, to eliminate the superstitious elements, and to fit it more fully into a category that they understand as religion. This shift is then taken abroad. One of the first things that Buddhist leaders start doing, Buddhist institutions, we now call Buddhist institutions, start doing, is sending representatives to European countries to figure out, even already there's an interesting shift because Oxford was seen as the place to do Buddhist studies for Japanese thinkers in Japan. There's a weird moment where this happens. The Doshinshu establishment sends some, the Japanese Pure Land establishment sends some thinkers to study with Max Müller. And here are a couple of the more important ones, Nanjo Bunyu and Takakusa Jinjiro. And this is in a moment where Max Müller is giving birth to religious studies as a field. He's also producing a sacred text project. Max Müller has been, in a way, beaten up about this. Masuzawa, for example, accuses him of producing a textual Buddhism, which bears little relation to any Buddhism on the ground. A similar argument is in Philip Ullman's The British Discovery of Buddhism. The interesting thing is these guys, Japanese Buddhist thinkers, are also inspired to produce a textual Buddhism out of the encounter. And they're helping Max Müller, although complicating some of his assumptions. And out of this comes something really famous. If there were graduate students of Buddhist studies here, they might have heard of Takakusa Junjiro as the early impetus behind the Taisho Tripitaka project. He picks up and in collaboration with Chinese thinkers, but also in Japan, he starts to produce a canon, a Buddhist canon of scriptural sources that become the authoritative version of scriptures. You might have wondered, for those of you who know nothing about Buddhism, people often ask, you know, does Buddhism have a Bible, things like that. There wasn't a standardized version of Buddhist scripture in East Asia before this time. Not at all. And it's this process that produces one. So we have, if there is a Buddhist Bible, and it's, you know, for us scholars of it who have chunks, it's like a wall, right? It's huge. Now most of people use C-Beta or whatever online, or, you know, there are different ways. There's different textual corpuses you can get access to digitally. But the Mahatma Foundation is one. But it's a long, large scripture. But the scripturalization process is very late. It's a 20th century process of producing a certain version of Buddhist scripture. Not that there hadn't been translations and attempts to produce catalogs of scriptures before. There definitely had been. And in a way relies on an older kind of panjiao or classification system already worked out in China earlier. But it does it in a new historical critical way, and it does it to produce a standardized form of Buddhism. Against this backdrop, we also have people defining themselves as Buddhist leaders who are staging Buddhism abroad. So we have a famous event that any historian of American religion will know, which is the World Parliament of Religions in Chicago in 1893. The World's Parliament? Yeah. Anyway, there are Japanese representatives to that. Some of this has been studied by Judith Snodgrass, but there's a lot more work to be done. Japanese thinkers start to stage versions of Buddhism at these. Significantly, Hidaya Kinzo pushes back against the assumption that Buddhism is nihilistic atheism, while another guy, Shaku Soen, is going to be even more influential. Shaku Soen argues that Buddhism is not just a religion, but it is a religion of science. It is a religion of science. And that's a term that had legs at the end of the 19th century. Europeans were looking for a religion of science. They saw as a major problem the disjunct of those categories. There were many attempts to produce religions of science, including histories of analytic philosophy, early American analytic philosophy, or attempts to produce a religion of science, actually. There are versions of that. And indeed, Shaku Soen has a major influence on a thinker named Paul Karas, who in a way is one of the contributing people who gives birth to the American Philosophical Association and tries to produce Western philosophy, analytic philosophy, as a solution to religion informed by Buddhism. There's a conversation we can have about that. I think it's really exciting, but I don't have quite enough time to tell you about it right now. At the same time that that's happening, Buddhist studies is starting to formulate as a discipline. These guys are also making, I should just say one more thing. These guys are also making bridges to kind of the pan-Asian world. They're meeting with Sri Lankan leaders. They're meeting with Chinese leaders. They're trying to argue about, what is Buddhism? Do we have a common tradition? Should we be defining ourselves as not part of Buddhism? Is Zen actually totally autonomous and not Buddhism at all? Or is Zen actually a type of Buddhism? So there are a lot of debates within the Buddhist world that have no European interlocutors as part of them, although often they have to fight with some folks called the Theosophists, who are claiming to speak for Western Buddhism and would show up at some of the same events and try and give their version of things. But anyway, there were a lot of debates around Buddhism as a pan-Asian phenomenon. Okay. Meanwhile, in parallel in Japan, we have the birth of Buddhist studies. So Tokyo Imperial University gets reorganized and effectively founded in 1877. And first case, the location of Buddhism is not in, there's no religion department, it's not even in philosophy, it's as a type of literature. So the first courses on what we would now, on Buddhism, this is the category that they use for it, are attempts to discuss it along in a larger literature course. They would read texts that they would associate with Buddhism, but in literary terms. You can imagine what might have happened had Buddhism remained only a feature of literature departments.
but not have made it into religion departments. But that was kind of at play in this period until Buddhist leaders staged Buddhism as a religion enough that people were like, okay, this isn't merely literature. And part of the way that they did that was through the establishment of sectarian universities, which start happening in Japan in the 1920s. Two of the most important probably are Watani University and Komizawa University. In each case, they're motivated by an attempt to kind of formulate, to transform and produce new styles of textual criticism, to produce authoritative canons, to enshrine not just Indian texts or Chinese texts as authoritative, but to locate Japanese texts within the canon formation of Buddhism. And a lot of the ways that those universities formulate their programs still have lasting impacts today as various thinkers are canonized or various themes about, for example, Edo period Buddhist decadence are then emerge in that context and are then repeated by scholars, not just in Japan, but in throughout the world. So the production of Buddhism as a category here in Japan in a new way, as a member of the category religion, has a lot to do also with the debates in these things. And these sectarian universities are inspired also by the formation of Christian sectarian universities in Japan, like Sophia, etc. So they see parallel formations happening there. About out of time. So, and then, you know, eventually you get people like, wasn't really a Buddhist priest, but on the Harvard's faculty, Anasaki here, staging a version of Japanese Buddhism, Nichiren Buddhism there. What am I trying to argue? Okay, it's been a long talk, right? But I want to try and hit a few things at the end and then open it up for questions. Maybe. So, first thing to argue here, I'm interested in this process. The way that this globalizing system of discourse around something called the category religion is in a way self-reinforcing and then captures other categories, even if incompletely. This is a process of modernity. This formation of the category religion has a lot of distinctions built into it. Something is religious and not secular. It is religious and not scientific. It is religious and not superstition. It also has some natural comparisons built into it. The category religion almost always has described, in some sense, a relation to Christianity. So as soon as Buddhists are part of a category called religion, for example, they get asked for their answers to Christian kinds of questions. Do you have a creator? What is the nature of creation? What is your stance on abortion? What do you think about homosexuality or whatever? There are a whole set of questions that we think religions are supposed to answer. Part of this is an idea of the historical conditionedness of the category of religion. The second point is that the European encounter with Buddhism was not merely Europeans coming with Buddhism in a way that had nothing to do with Asia. Europeans would have been, in some senses, happy to just colonize Asia and leave the individuals with no agency about and convert them or what have you completely. So we can see its production as the result of kinds of resistance that are being managed, but also ways that Christian thinkers or European thinkers in general use the category of Buddhism to meet their own internal debates and arguments. One way to make Spinoza seem very scary is to say, hey, he wasn't just some dude who's now dead, but he has a bunch of like-minded folk in China, and there are a ton of them, right? So it allows him to both defamiliarize or exoticize or orientalize Spinoza. I think that was a big part of Bale's argument as part of that, a little more complicated. But it also, you know, stages certain categories. And I think one of the things that people have underappreciated is the way that this idea of an atheistic religion, which is an interesting way, or a nihilistic religion, which is a way that people describe Buddhism for various reasons, based on their history of the perception of Spinoza. These are categories that were first attributed to Spinoza and then get transferred over to Buddhism. How that problematic shapes early religious studies. How, for Max Müller and company, the idea of a religion without a god as its center just really plays havoc with their category structures. Buddhism isn't the only example, but it's a very important one. Not just the encounter with Buddhism, but I see a kind of shift in the category religion itself. I talk about a little bit in the beginning of this book, but it's a shift between what I call the theocentric and the hierocentric definition of religion. a shift in, you've seen dictionaries, literally. Like, I'm not an arbitrary make out of my head. In dictionaries, between defining religion as the worship of God and inserting another term that stands in for God but is a barely disguised metaphor for God, like the sacred, right? So it's still a Christian category, but it's become partially de-Christianized, let's say. And that process is very recent, but but it comes in the face of the revival of so-called Oriental religions and atheistic science religions. You know, it's kind of a mess how many terms it takes in a dictionary before you hit recursion. If you look up the sacred, you get back to religion, and you look up religion, you get back to sacred. That shows that you've got a recursive terms that are having problems with each other. You don't get that if you look up apple, for example. But anyway, okay. Second, on the ground, if you have a Japanese Buddhist encounter, I should put Buddhist in quotes here too, we could talk about that, but with religion, that also caused an extensive reclassification of indigenous materials. It meant differentiations, it meant new concepts, new connections, new structures. Buddhists stopped doing a lot of things. People came to think of themselves as lay Buddhists in a way that wasn't the way they would have thought of themselves in the preceding period. They came to, they also, like, Buddhists stopped doing things like medicine, for example, in the same way that they were doing it. They stopped doing certain kinds of education. There were massive institutional restructurings. Property. They lost property. They got rid of breweries. There was a whole complex system of things Buddhists, the institutions we would now identify as Buddhists, were doing in that period. And it changes, and in good part because those activities were not covered by religious protection. So it's a differentiating process. And then, having partially weathered that, they staged modernized Buddhism to a larger audience. I want to make just one other, like, really mild intervention in case this is a crowd who's read too much about Buddhist modernism. I don't think it's an evaluatively bad thing that Buddhism undergoes. I don't believe in an authentic Buddhism that would have been better had it not changed. That would have been a fundamentalist kind of an argument. So don't mistake me for advocating some kind of traditionalism where Asia is not supposed to change, because this is a very interesting dynamic and creative process. I don't think they're making it up. They're not trying to pull one over, but they do have vested interests in describing the kind of Buddhism that they are to the world. That's where I'll stop. I think I'm on time, and I'm happy to answer anything you want about either the book or about this project here. Thank you. Second, if they hadn't, then they could have been wiped out by a whole host of things. Could have been totally displaced. Second, because Christian missionaries were saying in the time period, I have a bunch of great quotes, Buddhism is a superstition. Not just Christian missionaries, but a number of European thinkers of a secular stripe too were saying, what is there is just a backward superstition. So part of their argument that Buddhism was a religion was as a way to fit it in, to protect it. We have this idea that secularization tries to kill religion, but actually what it does is it preserves a kind of fossilized sometimes form or a transformed form of the things we call religions as long as they're willing to be interiorized or as long as they don't get in the way of other kinds of processes. So that provided, and they really felt in danger. In the 1870s, 1872, 1868 to 1872, the Japanese state looked like it was just going to wipe Buddhism off the map. There was a moment where it looked like there would be no Japanese Buddhism at all, as a backward artifice of the old government. It didn't work. It might never have worked, but some people thought that they might be able to do it. Yeah, go for it.
I was going to ask if there was like anything similar, the way things developed in Japan, but in China, or other places where Buddhism was similar.
Yeah, totally. I mean, what I see at least before the communist period in China, and I see this in the nationalists, so it occurs there as well, but are also debates around the category religion and its limits, debates around terminology, debates around pan-Buddhism and how to formulate that pan-Buddhism. And often, Chinese thinkers in that period often looked to Japan as having been ahead of the curve, in a way, because the British, you know, were absolutely horrible in China, right? The British were basically, in that time period, a bunch of thuggish drug dealers who colonized parts of the world and beat up. Literally, they addicted China to opium. The reason that the Japanese let freedom of religion in was because they added a clause, the Americans added a clause, and no opium will be sold. So that was the fear, you know. But the British had so destabilized China. Some Chinese intellectuals looked for internal resources. Some of them tried to reconfigure Confucianism as a religion. For example, they repositioned a new kind of, used new terminology to describe what we now call Confucianism. And they also looked to Buddhism, and they got as intermediate terms this Japanese term, Shukyo, which then they transposed into China. And it got especially important after 1905, after the Russo-Japanese War, when it impressed a lot of people that Japan had beaten up Russia. But then it got even more a problem because then the Japanese started colonizing Asia themselves. So the other way, it becomes a colonial imposition. So that's what happens in Korea, at least most specifically. It's in China, it's a little messier. But in Korea, the Japanese then start worrying about what counts as a Korean religion, and they decide that a bunch of things don't, and then Korean thinkers have to stage it. It becomes, it's restaging of a colonizing argument there. So,
like, how are things today? Is there a nice way to centralize them? How is the
Yeah, so, I mean, there's this interesting feature that you can see in the sociological literature. If you poll Japanese people and ask them, do you believe, and then or have faith, the word here is shinko, in a religion, using the word chukyo, a very low percentage of Japanese people will say they have faith in a religion. In fact, according to those things like World Values Survey, Japan comes in as one of the most secular countries in the world because of their answer to that question. Similarly, if you ask them if they believe in God, you get similar low percentage hits. At the same time, attendance at churches and shrines is actually very high. The numbers are hard to get, hard to take seriously because a lot of them are recorded by the shrines and temples themselves. But according to some versions of those metrics, you have church attendance on par with America, while a lack of belief that's lower than anywhere else in the world. So, and not only that, but a lot of Japanese people report attending both shrines and temples, so both Buddhist and Shinto institutions. So you might seem to have a secular country where everybody has multiple religions or something. So that's sort of the messiness of that category. That said, so there are ways in which that category is messy even today in Japan. There's another story about Amshin Rikyo in the middle, but we'll leave that off for the moment. Yeah. Other questions? Yeah.
So one of the things I'm curious about here is that your main sources, well, what I like most about the book is that it's, it takes into account diplomacy and
yeah.
how these things, it's,
yeah.
you know, it's intellectuals talking about this, but it's not just intellectuals.
Yeah.
There are actual policy implications
yeah.
between nations and within the nation. But I'm wondering if you could answer a little bit more, like what actually happens on the ground once you have freedom of religion, like are there things that were previously illegal that are now legal, or vice versa?
Oh,
like,
yeah.
Who gets their stuff
confiscated? Totally, yeah. I mean, and exactly, that's the kind of question that this sort of, when Buddhism or how Buddhism book is intended to answer. And let me give you a couple examples. Some of these have been studied in isolation, but we can kind of put them together. One thing that they're allowed to do once they suddenly have freedom of religion, and it's not identical to this moment, but it happens in the same moment, is a set of regulations that are against the backdrop of this debate that drop the government's degree of enforcement of monastic laws. So it's these Nikuchiki Saitai regulations about clerical marriage and eating meat and drinking alcohol. Now, those were only sporadically enforced anyway. They're on the, who knows. But what happens is the Japanese state says, we're not enforcing that anymore. But they also indirectly made it hard for Buddhist institutions to internally enforce that. So you have a collapse of their ability to regulate those kinds of behaviors, but understood as a you know, a new way to understand these kind of freedoms, right? It's not identical conversation, but it's against the backdrop of the conversation. Other things get confiscated. Lots of land gets confiscated, and temples get closed. And it varies by region. Some of it is some of these are temples that they're falling apart because the Buddhist institution can't maintain them anyway. There's an older Dhanka registration system that would. There are reasons that they had temples where they didn't need to have them, and they're bound to close anyway. Let's put it that way. But some of them were more forcibly closed. And part of it is that even a little bit before this process, you have a differentiation of Shinto and Buddhism. And this has been the most studied of these various things, and we can point you to plenty of literature that talks about it. You may have read up some of it yourself. But part of it is that Buddhism and Shinto get teased out as separate things from each other. And you know, and that hurts different Buddhist institutions in more or less ways. If you travel in Japan now, you'll often see shrines and temples almost on the same land, but that land gets partitioned into two different institutional structures. And often it was the same dudes performing rituals for both things, and now new people are coming in to perform some of these rituals. The institution hit hardest, I think, my sense, is it's the Tantric Buddhist institution, Shingon Buddhism, which is much bigger in the early period than most people acknowledge, and a lot of it gets turned partially into Shinto and destroyed. I could go on. Closing of Buddhist pharmacies, the elimination of certain kinds of healing, making it illegal to perform healing rituals of a certain sort, laying on of hands. They still happens. It's come back a little bit, but for a long period it was illegal to perform. And then their whole Buddhist sects that were banned as backward, that is not as not Buddhism, is too mixed. Like the Fukeshi, the guys in like samurai movies who wear the big hats and carry shakuhachis, they were declared illegal for a couple different reasons at some point in this period. Other questions? Yeah.
I guess it's like, did Buddhism ever influence the economy or politics or social
roles? Yeah, for sure. Part of their ability to stage Buddhism as a religion within Japan was part of the political process. So one of the things that I'm looking into in this next project is a little bit more about how the mechanics of how that worked. But basically, the largest, Joshin Shinshu institutions, one of the largest Pure Land institutions within Japan, even after they got a lot of stuff confiscated, they sold a lot of money. And they started using that money to lobby. And one of the ways that they tried to use that money to lobby was to fit Buddhism under the Freedom of Religion Clause in the Constitution. So if they hadn't had the money in the parishioner base, who knows what would happen? It might not have worked, right? You had to have people backing in, and you had to have funding backing in, and you had to have smart people that they had trained in the West advocating for it in lawyerly ways. So it was partially Buddhism's ability to fit itself into the evolving Japanese political process that let that happen, for sure. Yeah?
How would you see the Buddhism,
yeah.
As it has come into the United States in the last 50-100 years and in Europe.
Yeah.
You've been describing the changes in Buddhism in Japan as it encounters and tries to cope with European religion and philosophy. I've read that some of the response later is that it migrates in the form of the Zen teachers to different parts of the United States. When I started reading Buddhism in the 50s, it was hard to find good translations. Anyway, there are very few sources compared to today for texts and interpretation. Now I see a proliferation.
Yeah.
Some people think a watering down. Some people think it's been turned into psychology to make it popular in the United States. How do you regard this continuing change?
Yeah, so in the first case, you're right. I mean, So there are a small number of guys who provide translations of Buddhist texts. One of the most important is D.T. Suzuki, who comes out of this moment. He was Shaku Soen's student here, and he's already partially got a modernized version of Buddhism, and he's one of the proponents of that Buddhism, one of the main translators, one of the founders of Buddhist studies, one of the people who makes stages Zen for a European audience as a religion of science. There's no accident he's originally housed. Paul Karras is this guy trying to promote something originally called the Monist League, which was a religion of science movement. And he's the one that hosts D.T. Suzuki ultimately, or early on in his process, because he thinks that they're both matching up as religions of science. And then Karras gets converted and becomes an outspoken Buddhist. But it's a kind of a scientific, a Buddhism that has purged itself of its superstitions. And Zen is, for them, that version of Buddhism. It's a Buddhism of pure experience and a Buddhism that's psychology. And you can see D.T. Suzuki evolving with the times, and when the discourse of psychoanalysis comes in, he famously, you know, talks about Buddhism in terms of psychoanalysis. And then you have backlashes to that, right, both within Japan and in the West, that see there are all these interesting double standards about which things are allowed to modernize and which are not, and they're very fraught. There's a longer kind of conversation about that, but... So I think what happens, in a way, I think that the modernization of Zen is something that if we can either praise or condemn. I mean, I don't think that there's a moral argument to be made about it exactly, or not a straightforward one without a series of normative backgrounds behind it. You get a language, and I'm referring to a scholar of Buddhist modernism. There's a book called Buddhist Modernism, who has the covert argument that Buddhism modernized, and this is a bad thing. Right? His assumption is that there's a more authentic textual Buddhism or something, or a traditional Buddhism, as tends to be his language, that didn't undergo changes. It's a cryptic argument there. It's not quite explicit, but I think it's there in the book. I think that's sort of really weirdly short-sighted. He's like, Suzuki's just borrowing from Romanticism or whatever. But then the Romantics were looking to Asia, so there's a double problem here. It was in part the encounter with Buddhism that inspired, or Indian thought that inspired German Romanticism in the first place. So, I don't know, there's a back and forth that's missing. The long and short, just to give a more succinct answer to your question, is that there's an entangled trajectory. What happens in Japan and Europe and America bounce off of each other, and they become, timing-wise, to bounce off each other with greater frequency as we have increasing rates of global communication and translation. And we have backward influences, pizza effects, Buddhisms that are exported and then re-imported into Japan, just like pizza was, our modern pizza is basically invented in America and re-imported into Italy. My Italian friends may differ a little bit, but that's basically historically what happened. Or the Chinese fortune cookie, which is, comes from Chinatown and is re-imported. And then similarly, European thought forms are exported and re-imported too, as we can see with the pizza example. So yeah, that's the long shot is two entangled trajectories. Yeah. Yeah. One more question. Yeah, go for it.
You said that questions for religions are easily framed in a sense of Christian religions. Like, questions for Buddhism, like, abortion and etc. The questions are usually framed in that manner. So I was just wondering if you see Buddhism as attempting to answer a smaller subset of questions that Christianity tries to answer, or if it's a different section of reality, or if they overlap.
So, I mean, I definitely wouldn't say small. Let's say it gets really hard to locate Buddhism. If you really push it on, it gets hard to locate Buddhism in its own way, too, because the things that we call Buddhist scriptures have their own problematics. They have their own genre. They have their own, like, kinds of conversations they're having. Some of those, I think, have answers that are philosophically important or interesting that answer questions in epistemology or conceptions of ideas. There's a lot of Buddhism that's not about it's not about answering questions. That's about meditative practices or about rituals for various deities or funerals or what have you. So I would say, I always get my students to talk about Buddhisms with a plural. And I know we're in an age where we always put plurals on the end of everything. And that may be our current, it's a Deleuzian age, if that means anything to you. But that said, I think if we would interrogate Buddhism and try and make it speak to us, it would have different kinds of questions. We revive people all the time, right? People find it not weird to revive Aristotle and claim that Aristotle says something about abortion. That happens all the time, right? People are like, that's what philosophy departments often do. They revive some dead thinker and they try and put them in dialogue with a present concern. And if they've come up with an interesting answer based on that inspiration, it's good stuff. Theologians do the same thing, right? I mean, they look at the scripture, they look at the Bible, and they try and come up with an answer to a contemporary question. They ask the Bible, does it have something to say about abortion? The term isn't in the Bible, and then they find a way back in there to answer it, right? Buddhist thinkers similarly can do that and have done great things. But the proof is always, and the interesting thing to me is always what they've extracted and what they managed to come up with on its own terms. Not on its connection to particular traditions, I guess. But there are a lot of things you can interrogate Buddhist scriptures about and find answers, but they're not the same set as you can find as easily in the Christian materials. Thank you I think that's supposed to be the last question. Thank you.